Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What, you're looking something up?
No, actually, it's Mick the Merc ringing me about my Mercedes being serviced. How, I should have taken that.
Cubes, coils and curls cascade from his mind thoughts via and through his creations, casting luminescence upon our drear and grizzled porches. He is, of course...
Brian Clark.
Thank you.
That was a lovely introduction.
It was, wasn't it? I thought you said drear and grizzled paunches.
Well, it could be. It depends where the light's shining.
Yes. Anyway, it's very nice to have you here, Brian. And we were, just as you came in, discussing, you've got some... because it is a form of transport, walking. Do you like walking much? Are you keen a walker?
I do. I like walking a lot, though I have kind of stopped doing it really much. No, but no, I do like walking. Yeah, and I'm wearing these bright blue trainers that Francesca.
Peacock wore. Blue.
Yeah, they are actually. I never used to wear trainers because I used to think that there was something slightly suspect about them.
What changed?
Pain. Yeah.
When you get to a certain age, you start looking for a shoe that is comfortable and
I've got
a degree of style, and I think you have to go for something that's brightly coloured. Maybe that's an age thing as well. Bright colours, so you can see your feet when you walk.
but you said that you saw David Sylvester, one of the greatest art critics of all time, walking down the road, and he was wearing trainers, and it shocked you. What was your thoughts when you saw him in the trainers?
Well, I had always kind of regarded David as like the greatest art critic of his day, and he was almost unchallenged, really. And I saw him in Westbourne Grove, waiting to cross the road, and wearing trainers, and he was wearing a dark suit. And a tie, a shirt and tie, and trainers. And he looked very kind of dandruffy and dishevelled.
That's what trainers do to you.
Yeah, and I just thought, I'll never wear trainers.
And look at you now.
And look at me now. Yeah, and I, David's unfortunately died and gone. But I would apologise to him, though he never knew that I actually had that thought. I don't think I ever shared that with him.
No, then it turned out, it's just as well, because it's a bit like the people that, you know, change your mind, prove you've got one, as you said to me once, you know, you there you are, and you think, well, no, and here I am now wearing the trainers.
And have you ever worn any multicoloured trainers?
Well, I had some plimsolls with white stripes on the side of them, but I found my real problem was laces. So I like a slip-on. Because the laces, I find, can get undone. When you're making a quick getaway, you can trip yourself up.
I remember slip-on plimsolls. People used to wear them at the Blitz Club. We called them Blitz Pumps.
Oh.
And they didn't have laces, but they did tend to make people look effeminate. And if you don't mind me saying so, I rather suspect you would look effeminate.
But I used to go to the Blitz Club, and I used to wear those as well. And I did look effeminate, very effeminate. But they were called Chinese pumps. You used to get them in Chinatown, and they had little bits of elastic at either side.
That's it. And they've worked very well for the neuromantic thing. But I was like a bit too inhibited and stuck up to wear a Blitz pump.
What did you wear then?
I wore a kind of handmade lock shoes because I wanted people to know I'd made some money.
So you had the price tag.
The labels on.
Price tag hanging off the back. I've got a pair of lace-up boots on today, but it is a bit of a struggle bending down to tie your laces.
Oh, I haven't thought about the bending down. I was just thinking about the actual tying of knots.
Oh, you do it yourself.
I usually get one of my servants, but I had to do it myself today.
And, well, we're talking about transport and journeys and everything like that. Is it something you enjoy, travelling?
I used to enjoy travelling a lot, particularly when there was a reason for it. I never kind of got the idea of travelling for holiday or travelling for pleasure. There was always a kind of purpose to it. And so I used to travel kind of intercontinentally once a month at least, and internationally a couple of times a week. So I spent most of my times on aeroplane. But so many of my friends are dead because they travelled so much.
I mean, hang on, this is a travel, well, not a travel podcast, but a trans. Are you saying travel kills you?
Yeah. Yeah. The kind of travel we do now, I know a number of friends who I am quite convinced would still be alive if they had
stayed at home.
Yeah, if they did stayed at home more. And it was like a sort of replacement for really thinking or really doing work, I think, up to a point for me anyway. Like, you were on the move. And so I was always in aeroplanes, like scribbling and drawing and turning pages in sketchbooks, making ideas, only a fraction of which ever got fulfilled. But the actual movement was like the significant thing. And I do much less of that now.
Let's say you're travelling to America and you're going to put a stained glass window into somewhere in America. How do you get it there? On the plane? Carefully?
Well, they tend to be, the stained glass windows I do tend to be quite big in public buildings.
I know. So how do you get them abroad? Or do you make them when you get
there? I've never actually travelled with one, so far as I recall.
Oh, so they go on a freight, on a ship.
And they come in bits, you know, like they're in panels. So they make most of my stained glass, in fact, all my stained glass is made in Germany, and my mosaics are made in Germany and Italy, and they are then transported to their ultimate destination and installed by the craftsman who travel with them. And the installation can take up to, you know, a number of months. So that side of the process I tend to be a bit dislocated from.
So there's a lot of worry, isn't there? Like the potter in his kiln, thinking, is it going to explode when I open the door? So when you got your glass?
Yeah, I've had very little incidence of damage, or even though glass is very fragile, once it's actually ready to be installed, it's very solid. And I've had very, very little incidence over 40 years of doing projects globally of it being damaged, or, and I have zero experience of windows being vandalized.
Really?
Zero. There was once a window I did that birds flew into and smashed in France, and there was a window in Switzerland in a spectacular, though modest in scale, Cistercian Abbey, and the hailstorm was huge. The size, I mean, I know they always say hailstorm the size of golf balls, but it literally was, but it was actually being blown horizontally, and it smashed through the east window that I'd done. And I loved the windows there. I was very, very happy with them. It's quite modest. It's like, I think, only 10 or 12 windows. But the east window, which was an oculus, not unlike the one in your studio.
That means circular for the listeners at home.
An oculus.
Yes.
Yes. I was never quite comfortable with the design. I felt like there was a certain indolence to the design that I hadn't really come to terms with. And when it was installed, it was glaring to me. I'd just not pushed it enough. And then God came with his horizontal hailstorm, smashed it to
biblical
bits.
Biblical hailstorm.
And they asked me to replace it with his biblical hailstorm. They asked me to replace it. And I was given then an opportunity to replace it indolence-free. And I did and it's 10 times better than the one that was there before. And
so was it a hailstorm or did you throw it?
Yeah. I see you leaving here with a giant catapult some years ago.
Are you always absolutely happy when you're finished?
No, I always know when I'm finished. There's never a kind of ambiguity. I always know for sure that painting's finished. Usually if there's an element in it and I'm not quite sure about it, 10 years later, I'm really sure about it that it was wrong. 20 years later, I'm like embarrassed by it. When you make a mistake when I make a mistake in a painting, it's always where it's too self-conscious and I'm not like giving it enough thought, if you know what I mean. But the best paintings are all those that you make when you're a drainpipe and you're not even conscious of being an artist. You're just like a funnel through which everything is just like going.
Because really? Mistakes can be fun as well. My dad always used to say that he really loved Thelonious Monk because he liked all the wrong notes in it.
Well, yeah. Is the wrong note the right note? You know, that's... Yeah. Who's to say? Yes.
But it is... I did a webinar for a friend recently, and we were talking about this very issue, and I leaned forward to say, the accident is critical. And as I leant forward, a chair I was sitting on fell in bits.
The accident is critical. Yeah.
And it was like perfect. It was like a kind of flick of a hailstone down on me.
Yeah, exactly.
But seriously, I mean, I think that being an artist is like what a big part of being an artist, and certainly one of the most enjoyable parts of it, is actually enjoying the accident, enjoying the way nature just kind of struggles her way in, no matter what, and no matter how kind of daft or pretentious or kind of reasonable you are.
Yes.
And trying to work something out. Nature kind of
something
riddles
in,
and if you let that happen, you just can't go wrong, really. You just can't go wrong.
But what's your favourite way of travelling around? When you were travelling, is it aeroplane? Is it railways? Is it boats, cars, walking, bicycles?
Swimming.
Yeah.
I like luxury. I think so long as it's like got an armchair involved in it or something analogous to an armchair, it'll do me. But I'm not... I think the actual physical act of travelling isn't an excitement, it's the destination, isn't it? It used to be. I mean, when I first started travelling, air travel was really still... add an element of glamour.
VIPs.
Yeah, there was there was an element of glamour in it. And, you know, even within Europe, if you were poncy enough to travel first class, they used to give you champagne on your flight from London to Hamburg or London to Amsterdam. You're only up there 30 minutes and you got, not champagne, you got champagne and caviar and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it was all a little bit kind and...
Complimentary cigar.
Yeah, and on Concorde they used to give you little presents all the time.
Oh, you come loaded with stuff when you exit Concorde.
Lovely. I liked all that. But now, no matter how much you pay, you're quite recently, by which I mean a couple of years ago, before the pandemic, I was coming back from Paris and we had to... I can't remember the story, but I ended up coming on what was like a Ryanair flight or something of that sort. And the girl started pouring tea into a plastic cup for me. And I said, no, I want coffee. And she took the other... And she just carried on all the tea, put in the coffee and she went, you don't mind a mocha. Yeah. And I thought, really, the time has come for me to stop travelling.
Yeah. Really. This is what it's come to.
But it's like airport, I think it's like until the technology of the airport catches up with the technology of the aircraft, it's never going to be anything but miserable.
Mm.
I mean, you don't really know what a terminal illness is until you go to Heathrow.
Yeah.
And then it kind of dawns on you. I mean, it's about as miserable as human life gets. And also, of course, if there's a delay in a flight, you see how fragile the fabric of society is, because it's only a 2-hour delay and you see everything breaking down.
Yeah, people sleeping on the floor.
Yeah.
Fighting for food.
So it's... I think that destinations are great. Travel isn't what it was.
But there again, you see, I've discovered that in the places like Amsterdam, Paris, for instance, it's quicker to drive from London door to door. And also you don't get people sort of rummaging through your luggage, largely you don't, and having to take all your clothes off when you walk through the sort of security thing, you know, and having your guns and bombs taken away. It's so humiliating. So driving's quite a good way to get across Europe, I think.
I think, reflecting upon that question, I think that driving is probably the nice... I think now is of a glamorous holiday. I think it's like of motoring around Somerset and Devon or something.
In a luxury car with an armchair for a driver.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So you're talking about a Roller or a Bentley or...
Something like that. It would be very nice. But I don't... But the... I don't know. I'm a bit embarrassed about having big cars now. I used to...
Change like the trainer.
Yeah. It could easily change back. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. You never know which way it's going to go. I mean, I've got a big car that's got half electric, but the badges aren't big enough. So when I park, my green credentials aren't... I want to publicise them. I want everybody to know I've got a green car. Oh, he's look at him in his big car. But look, it's green, but the badges aren't big enough.
I anticipate that all private transport, or essentially, will evaporate, won't it, in due course, and it'll just be kind of really comfortable, wonderful public transport where you meet people. And
well, the car will be like it was in the Edwardian period or the sort of 1920s, where it was the preserve of the very rich, and the, you know, there was only one car in the street because only one person could afford one. I remember walking along a London street one time and hearing somebody shouting abuse at me, and look round to see it was you out of your car window, and you travel in the back of the car. I remember that.
What, in the back seat?
Sometimes.
But still driving.
Yes. Yeah.
Backseat driving. Now, that's something we haven't really gone into.
Well, my grandfather was a fabulous front seat, backseat driver.
Yeah.
My dad would be driving along, and I could see my dad getting more and more infuriated with my granddad sitting in the front, who would bang the dashboard. You'd go, left here! And my dad would go, where? He's going, back there! Yeah, backseat drivers.
I think it would be quite a good idea. You know, you get those stick-on steering wheels that children would have, like, on the, and so you could pretend you were driving.
Yeah.
To have those for backseat drivers, just to keep them, just like a child, you know, you just do that, turn the steering wheel. Or have dual controls, like you're doing a learner's car.
When I learned to drive, the instructor used to have a second set of pedals.
Yes.
That he could brake with, or I don't know if he had an accelerator, but he had a brake pedal, at least. But it took me 3 goes to pass my driving test. On the first occasion, I rolled back on a hill start on my driving test into a panda car, police car.
That's a very good start.
And on the second occasion, I did something equally silly. And on the third occasion, Mr. Mashita, my driving instructor, I was like 19 at the time, I think, he knew that because actually coming back to your early question and actually giving demonstrating a certain falsehood in my response or a lack of thought, and that was that in those days I used to make stained glass windows myself in this little studio in Preston, and I used to go and actually install them for the first couple of years, and I needed to have a car in order to make a living. And Mr. Mashita was acutely aware of this and aware that I couldn't afford any more driving lessons. And his mate was the examiner. And he obviously did some deal with his mate, because when we'd finished, the examiner said, I'm passing you, but for God's sake, find a disused airfield and practice. And
those were the days.
Yeah.
When the studio was being built, in the very early days, and Jim and Bob were next door writing their things, and we hadn't built this bit where we record the music, like where the whole big band could fit, and we've gone to record the TV shows and everything. And I said, Brian, you're, you know, such a, I'm doing this little studio, and would you ever think about doing a stained glass window? You said, absolutely, no question about that. I'll do that for you. Just put in an opening 1 meter across, just over 3 foot, and I will come and I will put a stained glass window there, because that's what a great thing. So here we are, some 2 years later. That's right. And where's the stained glass window?
Are you sure that was me?
It's...
because, but actually, as Jim said when we came in, it is double glazed.
The opening is. Well, we had to, because it was open. It was open for 10 years. It was just the elements were coming.
So it's all right.
Do something.
Yes. It's still all right. Then I mean, we can get right. No, yeah. I would. Actually, I feel embarrassed.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have brought it up on air.
Yeah.
Oh, well, why not? So what's the design? Have you got a design
in
mind?
No, he's a stained glass bloke, isn't he?
Oh, so you've got no say in it? You're not a suggestion or anything?
No, I just want to... No,
So,
Brian, what are you going to do on that ocular? He doesn't know.
Poppies.
Poppies.
Yeah.
Poppies, yeah. Yeah, vespers, poppies. Yeah, that's what I'll do. Yeah. I think I can see. Kind of, is there natural light there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Well, I will look forward to seeing that. I remember seeing. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was in Zurich, and there was a stained glass window in a church by A.R. Penck.
Yes, that's right.
Is it in Zurich? Yes.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And I remember looking at that.
Yeah.
There's two stained glass windows that I've spent a long time looking at them, and one of them is yours in Leeds.
Oh yeah,
in the Victoria
Quarter.
Yeah, yeah. And that I sat in a coffee shop looking at that for hours. And the other one is the one A.R. Penck one, which is fantastic.
There's a Sigma Polka window in Zurich.
That's it, not Penck.
Yeah,
it's a Sigma Polka
with the onyx. pieces of onyx.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
It's very kind of beguiling. You can look at that for a very long time. It's got a lot of detail.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
Zurich have also got Marc Chagall's window in the Fraumünster, which is a truly remarkable stained glass window. I used to kind of have difficulty with Chagall. I felt that there was too much translation of painting going on in the stained glass and not quite enough engagement with the medium. But the Fraumünster windows in Zurich show how callow that observation or that engagement with his work was. It's really fantastic. Best thing of all in Zurich, in my view, in terms of architectonic art, however, is the entrance to the police station. And the interior of the vaulted entrance to the police station in Zurich, which is open to the public, and the vaulted interior of the entrance hall is painted by Augusto Giacometti, the brother of Alberto, an extremely gifted family, and Diego, the sculptor, Augusto, stained glass artist and mural painter, and Alberto, sculptor. And it's a series of interconnecting cogs, really, like you would find in a watch, like Switzerland, I suppose it's opposite. And in muted, all muted, warm colours around kind of crimson through to burnt sienna through to kind of hard, dark pinks. And it is really spectacular. It's one of the greatest moments of, like, engagement with architectural art of the last kind of century and a half.
And also, I think you'll find that Zurich has a very low crime rate, which I would connect to the fact that the people are so happy to go into the police station and because they'd like to go in there to hand themselves in, to have a glance, momentarily pass through that portal.
Yeah, I would put it down to Switzerland being a benign police state myself. I think it's very frightening. I wouldn't commit a crime in Switzerland either, or in Saudi Arabia.
So when you passed your driving test, what was your first car?
Renault 4.
Was
it was actually a Hillman Imp van, which I bought off my friend Pat's dad, who was a second-hand car salesman. But I didn't realise that it was necessary to put a freeze deterrent in the water, in the
radiator.
And so I never drove it, unfortunately, because it became undrivable. So, and it was I had to borrow money to buy it. And I put it in this in this pale blue Hillman Imp van in a garage somewhere. And it froze up, and I never was able to drive it. So I had to borrow some more money to buy a Renault 4, which I did drive. And they had a gear stick that pushes in and out.
That's what I learnt on. My dad had a Renault 4, an orange one.
Yeah.
And in the 70s, and that's what I learnt how to drive on. That gear stick used to make me laugh all the time.
Yeah, it's funny how a gear stick can be funny, but it is. It is funny. And I had a few of them. I think maybe three of them.
Yeah, great. I think my dad got them because he went through a series of cheap cars, and also within those cars, he used to drive extraordinarily long ways to get cheap petrol, where it was like way out of the way, and he hadn't saved any money at all. But that was his thing, to get the cheapest and best car and the cheapest petrol.
I have no awareness, cognizance, knowledge of what a modern car is. If we went into the street now and you pointed to any car, it's very unlikely that I would be able to identify its breed. I know that's the Range Rover outside. Yeah. That one I know, but I can't. Yet, last night I was watching an episode of Endeavour, and it's set in 1960s Oxford, and I can identify every car in the show. That's a Ford Zephyr, that's a Zodiac. I can go through every... So I was acutely conscious of car make when I was a teenager. I don't know why. And I take great pride in being able to identify and accurately identify without fear of getting it wrong in Endeavour. But I couldn't point anyone out now.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When I moved to London, which was about late 70s, I'd kind of lost my connection to cars already. By then, I was like, just had an ad, but I was hanging out with a different crowd and I needed a new car. So I bought this car and I thought, fucking hell, this is like really a very glamorous moment for me. Apart from that, it was white, and that's kind of, you know, it's like really embracing vulgarity with strength and determination to have a white car, I thought. And it was a sports car, so fast and all that. And I went round to David Bailey's house. We were going out somewhere. I went round to pick it up. He said, "I'm not getting in that. It's a fucking MG. What are you doing with an MG? I'm not coming." I'm like, "We're calling a cab." He wouldn't come. We had to call a taxi.
Wouldn't get in an MG.
He would not get in it, no. And we had to call a taxi. And I only had it for a couple of weeks after that. I felt ashamed. I used to go out, kind of like, nip into it quick.
I wonder what his prejudice against the MG was.
I can't see any reason.
He said, and I remember this very well, he said it's a scampi belt sports car.
Scampi?
Scampi belt sports car.
Scampi belt?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It means that it looks like it's a good meal, but it's actually just scampi in a basket. So it has no speed, it has no real substance. Mm. It's just a pretend sports car. And I think that might be true. But then, since I never go above 30 miles an hour under any circumstances, if I'm driving, it kind of wasn't really an issue for me.
What did he drive?
A gold Rolls Royce that he put razor blades under the windscreen wipers because they kept getting pulled off. So he put razor blades on him.
Quite
so,
a good trick.
He had a collection of fingers in his grill.
Yeah, I don't know.
So detached fingers smeared across his
windscreen.
I mean,
he didn't do it every day. I remember that there was some story that he'd done it once. I don't know. But he did have a gold Rolls Royce and he had two nodding dog's heads in the back with a sign that said Bailey and Marie, who was his wife at the time. Yeah.
Well, I think, there we go. That's so typical of a person who, on snobby grounds, won't get into one particular vehicle, but then themselves, just look in the mirror, chum. When you're pointing a finger, just remember there are three pointing back at you.
Yeah.
There were two Rolls Royces parked outside Langan's Club around that same time, Langan's restaurant in Stratton Street, and Bailey and I came out of the restaurant one night, and somebody had sprayed on one Rich and on the other one Twats. Except it wasn't Twats that they were on.
Did you ever have a job? I always wanted a Batmobile. You know, I thought that'd be a good car.
That's got fins.
Yeah, but is there a car? Did you, when you were a child, did you think, oh, I'd really like, everything would be all right if I had a sort of whatever the car was? You know, what did you have a dream sort of thing?
I mean, I'm talking about Preston a lot. I only lived in Preston for a very short time, but it was obviously important because I remember in Preston walking into a garage one day and looking at a car. It was probably after my Hillman Impet kind of exploded, but I went into there was a car that had a brake that was a bit like the Renault 4 gear stick. It came out of the dashboard like that. And it had a lot of equipment, and it was a Peugeot. And I rather thought I could live in this Peugeot, but I don't know if I've ever even been in a Peugeot since. But do you say Peugeot?
Is it Peugeot?
Peugeot.
Although,
yeah.
I'm pleased.
I'm
pleased you said that, because when I was, my same friend who had a Renault 4, he said, anyway, we're thinking of getting one of these, and showed me the brochure. And I said, the Peugeot. He said, no, it's not pronounced Peugeot, it's pronounced Peugeot, you know, when you're 10. So not feeling rather stupid and not wanting to be caught out, I said, oh, no, actually, my granddad owns a Peugeot garage. That's how it said. Yeah. A huge lie.
But then he went out
making myself look even more stupid.
He went off and bought a Renault.
Yeah. That's right.
When I was doing art history at art school, when I was doing foundation course, I was very fond of Paul Gauguin, and it came up in conversation in a class, and I pronounced it Gorgin, and there was a kind of very cruel snigger. And then a repetition of Gorgin, Gorgin. Did you hear it? Yeah. He said Gorgin, Gorgin. And I didn't know. And I was, it's a very sad story in a way, because I panicked and ran out of the class. I didn't know what I'd done and I didn't know how to correct it. And I was only 15. And so to this day, I have trouble with Gorgin and Peugeot.
Yeah.
But there's always a lot of artists that you can quite easily get the name wrong. Most of them you know, but there's always going to be one here and there. I've got a couple of questions here.
Oh, actually, sorry.
I'm just going to ask them.
Yes, please do. Sorry.
You can answer them or not. What's the best thing that ever happened to you in a bus depot?
Oh, I can answer that.
Great.
I can answer that. Yeah, I discovered modern architecture. And I'm absolutely serious about that. In Preston, again, why Preston? Always Preston. Yeah. I never talk about Preston.
Once in a Preston guild.
But the Preston has a bus station designed by Ken Seed of Building Design Partnership in the early 1960s. And it is one of the most kind of visionary moments of brutalist modernism in British architectural history. And bus stations were miserable to me in those days, particularly because I had no other means of transportation except through what was provided by bus stations. And I always seemed to be sat on my own in a damp bus station. And I was so doing one night, waiting for a bus to Cheltenham or somewhere, in Preston bus station. And I realised what a masterpiece it was. Yeah. And I'd stopped looking at the mood and started seeing the building. And I
good tip.
It's a truly wonderful building. And that's the best thing that ever happened to me in a bus station, that I discovered the authority of contemporary architecture.
There you are. You weren't expecting that. But what a good tip. If you're in a bad mood, look at the architecture. Maybe that'll change things.
Especially bus stations, because they are great places.
So that turned out to be quite a valuable question, you see. You thought you were going to know. Have you got a similar type?
Well, I've got... have you ever got underneath a horse? Leave that anyway, thank you. Right.
Thank you so much for joining us on this podcast, Brian. It's a great pleasure to have you here. I didn't think you were going to be taking us to Preston bus garage, but you have, which was a great treat.
Yes, thank you very much for that. Thank you, Brian Clark.
Thank you.
Well, there goes Brian. Not travelling by air.
No, certainly not.
But in a luxury vehicle with an armchair fitted onto the bonnet.
Yes, back to his brutalist bus garage in Preston.
Oh, what a dream. This podcast was produced and edited by Molly Stewart.
Sound engineers were James Stewart and George Latham.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.